you very much, Steve, and thank you to Reem for making everything, setting everything up, and thank you to Zeifman's for hosting and once again providing lunch, which I know I certainly appreciate. The rest of the series, as Steve said, it's a three-part series. I'm doing the first two, and Ezra Deanna is going to give the third. Our topic for today, I put it on the source sheet. I think I varied a little bit from the flyer, but it's the same content. The Orthodox Accountant on Shabbat, and then next week is tax incentives. Amazon HQ2, sound economics, sound Judaism, ? On both. Before Ezra Deanna will conclude the series with the discussion of business lunches and the CRA. I also want to note a program run in tandem with B'nai B'rith on Tuesday morning, June 4th, with CE credit for accountants and lawyers on trusts and estates. I don't remember exactly what the topic is, but it's Tuesday morning, June 4th at Shari Shamayim. And I'll send out the flyer later, perhaps, so that everybody will have it. I'm actually going to send around sign-in sheets. The sign-in sheets are important for a couple of reasons. Number one, in case you would like notification about the rest of the series and receive email follow-up with a link to the audio recordings and so on. And the other is, if you are going to claim credit for having been here, it's good for us to be able to confirm that you actually were here. So, we have two choices. Either sign in, or I could ask someone to take pictures of the room. And pictures aren't bad, but signing in is better. So I'm going to start the sign-in sheets with Shlomo over here. If you already received email for this, you do not need to put in your email address. If you received email for this, that means that I have your email address, but signing with your name would, again, be appreciated. Finally, in the event that you have a cell phone and you are able to... You want to just take them? I'm not going to keep them out from here. Thanks. In the event that you have a cell phone and you could put it on vibrate or silent, I would greatly appreciate it. It's best to remind people of that now as opposed to after the phone rings. So, I have something of a split between my two topics in the series. The first one, the Orthodox Accountant on Shabbat, is really fairly, dry technical, as I think of it. And then the one for next week is much more theoretical, philosophical about economic policy. So, if you like one type more than the other, you have both. This session, this topic, is less about the particulars of business and accounting, and it's more about the professionalism that a financial services professional is expected to bring to the table and how to maintain that in the face of religious obligations. If you take a look on your sheet at the first source from the preamble to the CPA Ontario Rules of Professional Conduct, members in firms have a fundamental responsibility to act in the public interest. The public's trust and reliance on sound and fair financial and management reporting and competent advice on business affairs and the economic importance of that reporting and advice impose these special obligations on the profession. They also establish firmly the profession's social usefulness. So there's a responsibility to act in the public interest, to act in a way that will be called, for lack of a better term, professional. It will be good not to define a term with itself. But professionalism means being professional. Well, what does that look like? Take a look at source number two, also from the preamble. Defining professional behavior. Chartered professional accountants conduct themselves at all times in a manner which will maintain the good reputation of the profession and serve the public interest. In doing so, members and firms are expected to avoid any action that would discredit the profession. There are business considerations involved in the creation and development of any organization, whether it is a professional practice or an entity that operates outside of that domain. A member's involvement in any organization should be based primarily upon a reputation for professional excellence. In particular, members who occupy positions of senior authority should recognize that such positions include an obligation to influence events, practices, and attitudes within that organization. Accordingly, such members should encourage an ethics-based culture in their organizations that emphasizes the importance of ethical behavior and compliance with generally accepted standards of practice of the profession. At all times, members and firms are expected to act in relation to other professional colleagues with the courtesy and consideration they would expect to be accorded by their professional colleagues. What does all of this have to do with Shabbat? Why am I reading all this? Yeah. not just in order to make sure that you get credit, because we read something out of the preamble to the Rules of Professional Conduct. One of the issues in professionalism is making sure to provide not only courteous service, not only good service, but timely service. To be able to respond to people's requests, needs, in a timely fashion. CPA Ontario does not see fit to actually put that in their definition of professionalism. In contrast, the Law Society does. If you take a look at number 3, the Law Society's Rules of Professional Conduct, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. So the lawyers are supposed to be prompt. The financial services professionals, the CPA Ontario doesn't say so, but I think it is implied within professionalism. Now, one could say that's easy because Shabbat really isn't on duty time, meaning it could be that people work on weekends, but officially they're off. So what's the big deal? Why is this going to be a challenge? But the answer is really not just Shabbat, but also Yom Tov, also holidays. How do you deal with the situation in which there is a deadline, perhaps, that comes up during Passover, Pesach, right? Can happen easily, right? Originally American, tax deadline is April 15th. Here, April 30th. The issue of deadlines and getting papers to people, getting them signed, getting them filed in April can be very tricky when you're working around a Pesach schedule. So those are the types of questions I want to look at. How do you deal with Shabbat, and more relevant, how do you deal with Yom Tov, with holidays? So that the three questions I want to address are set out here where it is marked questions. Already. Okay, yes.
It's just interesting. The end of the second source, to act courteous in a way you would expect to be courteous, almost rings. Very, very much.
Oh, yeah. Right, absolutely. We say love your neighbor as yourself, and indeed Hillel's gloss on it, as brought in the Talmud, is that which is hateful unto others, do not do to them. It was very interesting. I mentioned this also in a session for lawyers the other night. I was outside the Bayit in Thornhill on a Friday a couple of weeks ago, and there was a balloon company that was dropping off balloons for a bar mitzvah. And it must have been some heavily Christian company, because it had all sorts of slogans from the New Testament written on the van. Like they had, you know, done it nicely on the side of the van. And there was one of them that said, love your neighbor as yourself. But below that it said, Mark. I said, who's Mark? What does Mark have to do with that? It should say Moses. We believe in these things. And yes, the structure of it, act towards them as you would want them to act to you, I think does ring. So the practical questions that you have here are listed under questions. The first one, a tax filing is due on Passover. On the eve of the holiday, Karen, who is Jewish, realizes that she will not finish the filing before she leaves the office. May Karen give the appeal? I wrote appeal, I think, because that was I took that from a session for lawyers. It shouldn't say appeal, it should say tax filing. But may Karen give the papers to her assistant to file? The assistant is not Jewish, let's say. Is Karen allowed to give it to her non-Jewish assistant to take care of on the holiday? What? Why not? I've got a why not, yeah.
He gives her a whole bunch of stuff a couple of days before, which could be finished before that day. And she doesn't know exactly when she's going to do it. Does that have any impact on you?
Potentially, yes. Potentially, yes.
You can't ask somebody to non-Jews do something which you're not allowed to do on Shabbat. However, in this situation,
is it due on
Shabbat or on
Kalamoid?
Let's say it's due on Chol HaMoed. It's an intermediate day, so the holiday that it's due. Yeah, then how will that affect you?
Yeah, but for the assistant, it's not a holiday. It's not a Chol HaMoed.
For them, they're not Jewish. It's not their holiday. Steve?
Yeah,
Steve?
The way
I look at this is, it's her responsibility to file it. It's not just his responsibility. It's not like he has a job to do and he's asked a non-Jew to do it for him. He has a job to do, she has a job to do. And filing return is her problem as much as it is his.
That's interesting.
And therefore, it's a partnership.
Exactly.
So therefore, I think that even though she's not a professional, let's assume, in the argument, she's an assistant, and she's not a CPA, but she's part of an organization whose job it is to satisfy clients and get things done. So I argue, potentially, look at it and say, look, this is not, no personal benefit for him. He's got to get these things done. The firm has to get these things done. Well, he's got personal benefit to get the year, but he maybe can argue that he's just sharing with her what would anyway be her responsibility,
right,
even if it wasn't.
So that would be a different way to frame it. It comes up all the time in terms of medical care, right? Doctors who want to switch call with somebody else, and we'll say, well, it wasn't my call. It was called for the clinic, for the group, or for whoever it is on the floor, and so I don't want to, you know, take it this day, and you'll take it instead, and I'll take it on your day, or whatever the case may be. What about if, actually, Irving, you were going to add, or? Okay.
What's the difference in that situation that you just described that I quote, shoves going?
Ah, that's a very good question. There is this practice that has existed in Jewish communities for a long time of asking someone who is not Jewish to take care of things on Shabbat. That's part of this question, is this in fact different from that? The another variation on this will be, what if the assistant is Jewish? Now what do you do? I'm not going to open that to question, only because, you know, I'm trying to keep this within the framework of the lunch, not holding people late, so that's another question. But take a look at the second one. Three friends from school wish to set up a firm together. Two of them do not observe Shabbat, and one of them does. The friends are willing to cover for the Shabbat observant accountant on Shabbat and holidays. May the Shabbat observant accountant enter into this partnership, where I'm going to benefit from the work that my Jewish partners are going to be doing on Yom Tov, on Saturdays. What's the then what do you do?
There's a regular law that if you have a company, mm-hmm, and your construction, like the Rathmans and others did, that Shabbat was owned by someone else, the prophets, and the rest would be the rest of it. It's the standard way.
Right. So Moshe says, avoid the whole problem. Just create a special arrangement in the beginning, and we'll talk about that.
My thinking that, yeah, these people being non-Jews, then so you do that. Like having a non-Jewish partner, business stays open on Saturday, that's fine. Because, but if they're Jewish,
no, they are Jewish. They are Jewish. Yes, all of them are Jewish. No, they're Jews. I didn't actually word it carefully in the question, so you could have read it either way, but that's true. I have a third question here, which is fascinating on a theoretical level, and if we have time, we'll get to it. If not, you can just read the sources that I included there. But when I gave a session on Shabbat work for lawyers, so one of the questions was, well, what about where my law work is actually life-saving? Now, not life-saving in the sense of dashing into a burning building or treating a patient, but indirectly life-saving. So look at the example. James is stuck in Colombia, where a local drug cartel is pursuing him. He's trying to flee to Canada, but his visa application is held up. May his Jewish immigration lawyer, Judith, pursue the application on Shabbat. Indirectly, she could be saving his life. So I gave you, if you take a look before we're done, in sources 23, 25, cases in Israel of indirect activity, which also could be life-saving, not in the context of the practice of law, but in one case, notifying soldiers in the field that their movements are being broadcast in the media, and therefore they are, you know, under threat, or notifying the media that a rocket was fired against Israel from a hospital, from a school, or whatever it is, to forestall a harsh response when the IDF fires back and ends up potentially harming civilians. So that's, yeah, those aren't legal work, but the question fundamentally that we'll get to, if there's time, is the question of indirectly saving lives, and how would that figure in? But that's not really, I couldn't come up with a case like that for accountants. I kept trying to figure out a way, you know, unless you're going to start working with the mafia, in which case, yes, this may be an issue. Okay. Yeah, I see the sign-in sheets are over here. If people in the middle could also make sure to do the sign-in, that would be wonderful. Thank you. So let's get started on our first case. Thanks. Our first case is the non-Jewish assistant. So again, the filing is due on a holiday. It's on Pesach, and I'm not going to be able to get it done before I go home. Can I give it to my non-Jewish assistant? So we've already discussed this a little bit, but let's try to frame it carefully. What are the problems halachically? What are the problems involved in having the non-Jewish assistant do that? And let's say it's actually, I say to them, it is now 5 o'clock on the eve of Pesach is coming in at 7 o'clock, right? Not in Toronto, daylight savings time, and so on. It comes in like 9, but fine. It's coming in at 7 o'clock, and I say to them, this has to be filed by noon tomorrow. Here it is. Here's the stack of papers. What is the problem with doing that? What in technical terms? Yes, Gershon.
Because it says lo sase malocha,
yeah,
etc. So the question is, does this co-worker or associate, what do you want to call him, come under one of these categories?
But, and I think the answer is no.
Can you say lo sase malocha? Is it your work or is it somebody else's?
So the text is actually right. The text is actually worded in terms of your work. You shall not do. Right, they're not your slave. They don't, assuming they're not your child, that would not seem to be an issue. There are three potential issues, but that's not one of them. What are the issues? Yeah, Chaim. Right, so one issue, Chaim calls it Amir al-Akum, literally speaking to someone who isn't Jewish. I have a prohibition against assigning somebody who isn't Jewish to do work on my behalf on Shabbat and holidays. Technically, the term Amir al-Akum would apply if on Shabbat, on holidays, I ask them to do certain work. However, the prohibition is in making him my agent, even if I do so before Shabbat, before the holiday. So for example, if you take a look at source number 4, the Talmud has a discussion about a Jew who is traveling between cities on the eve of Shabbat and doesn't arrive before Shabbat begins. And he's riding an animal and he has a wallet with him or whatever it is. And the question is, could you give it to somebody who isn't Jewish for them to transport into the town? And Rashi comments on the Talmud's question. The Talmud there asks, and I always bring you the Hebrew original along with my translation, but I'm not going to read the Hebrew aloud in the interest of time. The Talmud asks, why did they permit giving a wallet to a non-Jew to transport it on Shabbat? And Rashi explains the question, isn't he then his agent to carry it on Shabbat? You're not allowed to make him your agent. His deed is your deed. And that's problem number one, even though he's not Jewish. The fact that he does it means that you are doing it. Now, Steve's conception of this to say, well, maybe it's not really he's working for you, he's working for himself, because it's the firm's responsibility, goes back to the question of how do you determine who is, so to speak, the owner of an activity? And largely that's with liability. So, in the event that this isn't taken care of, who is going to be the one who's going to get zapped for it? It's not the assistant. So, therefore, it's hard to argue that there's shared responsibility.
Is there an argument that a non-Jew doesn't have a lot of status as an agent?
So, from a technical standpoint, right?
Physically an agent, but
yeah. Right. Right. So in matters of Jewish law where agency, shlichut, is a technical requirement, it's true that I cannot ask someone who isn't Jewish to do that for me. So for example, a man is going to marry a woman, and in order to do so, he's going to give her a ring. He can technically appoint a shaliach, right? He can appoint a proxy who will give her the ring. However, you can't ask someone who isn't Jewish to be the one to give the ring, because for him, Kiddushin, the whole law of marriage within Judaism, it doesn't apply, and he can't be your agent. For this purpose, though, it's less of a technical thing. They are considered, in fact, to be working on your behalf. You ask them to do it. They are your agent, and this, in fact, is your deed. So that's one concern. Jerry?
When you hire a salesman, you just hire them to do one issue. You hire them on an annual basis, a monthly basis, and stuff. Do you say you're working in this office on a monthly basis? Paying you for a month. All your instructions are for a month. I'm not telling you with Shabbos, I'm not telling you with Sunday, I'm not telling you with Monday. This is your job. You've got to do it during this month.
Right.
So
So what Jerry raises is a good solution potentially for a different problem. Meaning, the idea that if you're paying the person for their work, but you're not paying them for that specific action, you're paying them globally for being the worker who does this, for you know this sort of thing for your firm, that doesn't help you in terms of agency. He's still your agent. You told him to do this on this day. Where it may be relevant is the second concern. The second concern is commerce, meaning paying for work done on Yom Tov, on Shabbat, is an act of commerce. It's not about assigning the work. It's about paying for it. If I pay somebody by the hour, if I pay somebody by the day for their time, even if I do it in a long-term deal, if I am paying by the hour, then I have a problem. Why? Because we have a prohibition against mekach u'memkar, against commerce on Shabbat and holidays, saying to somebody, you worked X number of hours on Saturday, X number of hours on holidays, and I'm going to pay you X times whatever dollars per hour it is a fundamental problem. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in the Mishnah Berurah talks about this regarding paying someone who isn't Jewish for something done on Shabbat. So he writes, don't pay him. This is rabbinically prohibited due to commerce. So now, in the event that you're talking about someone who's not paid by the hour at all, you pay them a lump sum for working for the firm, then I agree. Then you've solved this particular problem. The issue is where the type of work that they do gets paid by unit of time. By the hour, by the day, that's where you have this consideration. Yes, Miriam.
Piecework as well? That's also...
Yes. No. Piecework would not be. Piecework meaning there's a very particular task to be done, and they're going to be paid for doing the task, but think of the difference between independent contractor, right, and employee. They're going to choose where to do it, when to do it, how to do it. I just care that it gets done. Exactly. Piecework does not have this problem. They're not paid. They're not saying to me, I worked for 5 hours, and therefore you have to pay me X.
Unless you're doing it by return.
What does that mean?
Tax return.
But still, you're not being paid based on the time invested, unless you are, unless that's how the calculation works. Yeah, Jerry.
What's the definition of an agent?
Somebody I tell to do something, and they're responsible for not having done it.
I'm a professional, and I'm an accountant, and somebody comes to me and says to me, please do this for me, and I'll pay you for it. I'm not an agent. I'm doing a business transaction with you, not as an agent. I'm responsible for what it depends if I'm responsible or not. It depends who's responsible. That's the key. Who's going to have responsibility in the end?
So, Jerry raises an interesting question, meaning I've really formulated this in two different ways. My first concern is the agency concern, in which it doesn't matter who is paying whom, it's more boss to somebody who is being bossed. Somebody saying, I want you to do X, and the other one saying, okay. The second one, the commerce concern, is really the concern of employer-employee. Two people who both work for a company, right, and are paid by the company, are not in an employer-employee relationship. They're both employees, just that one has a certain spot within the command structure and the other one has a different one. So you're right, both of these may not apply to any individual case. One may be more one may be more the other. But these are both potential concerns. The third concern is society. And this is the classic concern for Maris Ayin, the issue of appearances. I bring you one of the classic sources for it, a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi, it's source number 6. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman quotes Rabbi Yonatan. We find in Torah, prophets, and writings, the three parts of Tanakh, that one must satisfy others as one must satisfy God. Meaning, there is a basic responsibility that just as I have to be innocent in the eyes of God, I can't do anything which others will think is wrong. For two reasons. Right? One reason is because if they know it's wrong, they're going to think ill of me. And two, if they don't know it's wrong, I'm going to be teaching them improper behavior. Right? You can run afoul of this on opposite sides of the situation. Either they think you're bad, or they think you're good, and they think that what you're doing is actually allowed. And he quotes you biblical verses from each part of Tanakh. Bamidbar first, from the Chumash, and you shall be innocent from God and from Israel, meaning you have to be, you have to conduct yourself in such a way that no one will suspect you of wrongdoing. Then from Yehoshua, Kel Elohim Hashem. There's a fascinating story at the end of the book of Yehoshua, of Joshua, where the tribes of Reuven and Gad, along with part of the tribe of Manasseh, are crossing from the western side of the Jordan back to their new homes in the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they build a big altar right at the spot where they're crossing the Yarden, where they're crossing the Jordan, and the rest of the Jews think this is a breakaway temple that's being created. And they respond, absolutely not. No, by no means. That's not what we're doing. And they say, God knows and Israel will know as well. That's not our intention. What we were doing was creating a monument so that everybody should be aware we're part of the Jewish people. That's why we were doing it. But again, it's the insistence on not only God has to know I'm right, but other people have to know I'm right. And finally, from Mishlei, from Proverbs, the imperative to find favor and a reputation for good insight in the eyes of God and man. So I have to be really careful not to in any way appear like I'm doing something wrong. So for example, in the case that we're talking about, let's say I do it entirely on the up and up. I am paying them by the job, not by the hour. And let's say I solve the agency problem in the way that we're going to identify shortly. But people don't know. People don't know what I'm doing, and they don't know what the arrangement is. Then I still have a problem of Marisai and the issue of appearances. Yes?
What about you've agreed to file this person's tax return, your client's tax return? There is a deadline. If you don't file it on time, they're going to potentially incur a lot of penalties and fees. How does that play into it?
So that's exactly the problem. Meaning, if that weren't a tension, then I would just say, okay, so put it on hold. Right. And the answer, I think, is the Jewish fellow who's now, or I shouldn't say fellow, by the way, you understand that. I default to male because I'm a male, but no, this is men and women alike. This is the responsibility of the Jewish person who says, well, Jewish law doesn't allow me to do it. The answer is, well, then you shouldn't have accepted that you were going to do it. This is on your head. You can't wave it away and say, well, Jewish law doesn't allow me. That doesn't work. Miriam.
So can you say, like, within a firm, make sure you get the returns for the Jewish partner done these days, and you can do the ones for the Gentile partners on Shabbat. Can you do that?
Can you make a trade?
Make some sort of, do those.
No, that's a legitimate question. Let's see if that gets answered by what we're going to say as I present the solution. As I wrote in number 7, you have a three-part approach here, because there were three problems. Your basic answer is, don't assign the work or pay for it for Yom Tov, for the holiday, and don't appear to do so. But the way it breaks down is, first of all, to solve the problem of agency, make sure that they're acting independently by doing so on Yom Tov, on the holiday. Don't tell them, do it that day. So, for example, assuming that this is true, I'm giving it to them on 5 o'clock on the eve of Pesach. I can say to them, get this done sometime in the next 5 days. I happen to know they're conscientious. And it's Tuesday, right? Well, it can't be. Sorry, it's Wednesday. So Pesach, the first day of Pesach is Thursday. First day of Pesach can't be a Wednesday. But it is currently Wednesday afternoon. I can say to them, can you get this done by Monday? But I know they're going to get it done on Thursday. That was their decision. I gave them that period of time, much like you will see people go to the cleaners and drop off clothing on Friday, and they'll say, I'll pick it up on Monday, I'll pick it up on Tuesday. They know the dry cleaner operates in a certain way. The dry cleaner is going to get it done on Saturday, but it's not my headache, because I didn't make them my agent to do it on that day. I gave them a period of time in which it could be done.
That's only if you know that they can do it. If they're going to do that, you know they can do it, and there's no time before. In other words, if you do it at 5 o'clock, it's a 4-hour job.
Right. So I can't tell them to do it tomorrow.
It is 4 hours before you tell them.
There is potentially one additional. There is potentially one other solution. In the event that somebody's stuck and they don't know that this person is going to be conscientious. You told me I had 5 days. Why are you upset that I didn't get it done the next day? There is potentially one other solution if someone is in a case of need. There's a debate regarding what's called amira de amira. What Amira da Amira means, I mean literally is saying of saying, what it means is this, and it sort of goes back to Steve's point about what the structure of the organization is and who's really responsible. Let me give you a different scenario that's easier and simpler to portray it. Somebody is in the hospital, and it is Shabbat, and they want to get information about their situation to a Jew. They don't want to call them themselves. It's not life saving. It's just that they want them to be aware of what's going on. So let's say their plan is that they know the phone number for the non-Jew who lives next door to their relative, and they want to call the non-Jew and just go next door and tell them, right? But they can't, because I can't call. It's not life-saving. I can't tell someone who isn't Jewish to call, because that's Amira Lakum. That's telling someone who isn't Jewish to do something on Shabbat, and it's not really justified. So in a case of need that doesn't rise to the level of you can violate Shabbat for this, there are those who argue that what you can do is ask someone who isn't Jewish to ask someone else who isn't Jewish to do it. Why? Because what I am asking this non-Jewish person to do is not a violation of Shabbat for them. It's not anything. There's no rabbinic prohibition against non-Jews asking people not to do things on Shabbat. And then the person who's actually going to make the phone call is not doing it for me. They're doing it for the non-Jew who asked them to do it. So that's a potential solution. It's subject to some debate, but it does exist. And if I had a situation in which this has to get done on the first day of Pesach, there's no room for it not to get done, and I can't ask directly, but maybe I could say to someone who isn't Jewish, listen, I can't ask you to do this, so I'm not. But if you could ask someone else who isn't Jewish to take care of it, when they're done laughing, it might get done, and you're still potentially in bounds. Jerry.
Is it followed up that if you need to get something done, you hint at it, you don't go exactly. You bring him in the morning and say, look, we'll be in big trouble. This thing has to get done before Pesach.
Right. So there is a potential approach, which is the approach someone asked before about the classic Shabbos Goy structure, having a non-Jew do things on Shabbat. So there is the possibility of hinting where you hint before that day. Meaning, you can't hint on Yom Tov. You can't hint on Shabbat. I've seen people make mistakes with this repeatedly. Unless there is an overwhelming value, like the needs of a community or illness, you can't hint to someone that day. So, for example, I forgot to set the heat properly, and it's, you know, springtime in Toronto, and therefore it's, you know, 1 degree out. And we're all freezing in the house. So it would be legitimate for me to invite over someone who isn't Jewish and say, would you come over and you know, we'll talk or eat a snack or whatever it is. They're sitting there. They recognize it's cold. Maybe you even say to them, yeah, I didn't expect it to be this cold, but I can't do anything about it. And they'll realize, okay, and they'll change it because being cold is considered to have an element of illness. Or you're in shul, and the lights are off in the sanctuary, and people aren't able to daven, so it's for the sake of a mitzvah for the community, so they turn on the lights, and potentially that's acceptable. But other than that, for personal need, I'm not allowed to even hint to them on Shabbat. I'd have to hint to them in advance. So that potentially could work, but it's hard to imagine how that would work in this setting. Everything is pretty direct.
You know what? You bring them in to do the job with you.
And they say, okay, hold the door, please, I'm coming too.
She knows, if I get to turn my oven, like this shut off, the lights will go on, says, oh, I can't eat today. She comes just, okay. She says, I don't say a word.
So I'm not going to go into specific scenarios. I'm going to say what I meant to say in the beginning, and I'm not sure I said it, and I don't know why I would have skipped it, but I'm going to make doubly sure. For all practical issues, you must consult with your rabbi. I am not answering particular questions, and I am not giving practical guidance. I should have said it clear in the beginning, and I don't think I did. So I'm saying it now. Irving, and then I'm going to go further with this.
If fundamentally, in law, one cannot do indirectly what one cannot do directly, and so, speaking, that answer to all, I think, the questions that come up with respect to the laws about Shabbat and the examples that you gave. Because indirectly, you are trying to do what you cannot do directly.
So clearly what we're talking about are cases of need, number one. But number two, it's not true that indirect is the same as direct. So for example, one of the issues that we're dealing with, I didn't descend to technical points much within this, but one of the issues that we're dealing with is that mentioning the activity itself is problematic on Shabbat. I'm getting around that. In my hint, I don't use the verb. I don't say writing this. I don't say driving there. I don't say filing this. I actually do get around the problem. But to discuss more why this works would involve a greater digression that I don't think we can do right now. So what I'm trying to do is solve the agency problem by having them act as independently as possible. I don't give them a deadline on Yom Tov, and I don't instruct them to do it on Yom Tov. And again, the possibility of hinting before Yom Tov and the possibility of asking a non-Jew to ask a non-Jew in a case of real need do exist. But that doesn't solve my commerce problem. If I am paying them for work on Shabbat, that's still commerce. So therefore, what I have to do is one of two things. Either treat them as a contractor, what we call in Hebrew a kablan, so that they are paid by the job and not by the time. Or you do it with what's called havla'ah, meaning you absorb the payment for this within the payment for their greater work. So if they are paid for having put in 30 hours or whatever it was over a period of time, the fact that 3 of the hours happened to be on Yom Tov is not my problem. It gets absorbed into everything else. Sorry? Okay. But what about society? What about the fact that people are going to see this and not understand? So it has to be well known that this is the arrangement. Everyone has to know that this is the way that it is done. You have to arrange it in a permissible way, either in a way where no one is going to see and no one knows that it's for a Jew, or alternatively, if it's a type of work which is generally done in a permissible arrangement, then you specifically do it in public. Meaning, have it done in private if it's the sort of thing that could mislead people. But where it's the sort of thing which can be done on the up and up, and is normally done on the up and up, then don't hide it, because if someone finds out, they're going to think you're doing something wrong. The Magen Avraham mentioned this in source number 8. Take a look. I like this. Rabbi Avraham Gambiner, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, deals with the problem of trash being collected on Shabbat, on Yom Tov, by people who are not Jewish. And he says, in our city, we permit hiring non-Jews by the task, meaning you're not paying them for their time, but by the job, to collect trash from the street. The non-Jews do it on Shabbat. One must assume that a great sage permitted this on the ground. There is no suspicion in public actions. If it's being done in public, everyone's going to assume you must be doing it right, or you wouldn't be doing it in public. That's the idea. But then he notes, a separate point, I've seen that some great sages do not wish to permit it. For now, the non-Jews do not permit public work on their festivals. If we would permit it, then there would be desecration of God's name. Meaning, it's all well and good. You've satisfied the different provisions of Jewish law. However, they declare statutory holidays on their festivals, and they don't have people doing public work. They don't have trash pickup. They don't do all these things. The Jews, on the other hand, are willing to have these things done on their holidays. It looks like we don't take our holidays as seriously as they do. So he has this completely different concern that he notes in that case. Okay, that's the non-Jewish assistant case. Miriam.
Karen was a single Jew in a small town that really knew very little about Jewish rules. Would it be so necessary to worry about that particular...
The issue of appearances. So this is actually a very good question. There's a debate. Meaning, we have a basic principle which says that if something is prohibited because of appearances, it's prohibited even b'chadrei chadarim. Even if you're in a room inside of other rooms, no one can see you, it doesn't matter, it's still prohibited. However, there's some debate as to which types of prohibitions that applies to. One argument is that only applies to things that are biblically prohibited, where people are going to think you're violating biblical law because biblical law is more severe. The other argument is just the opposite, that it specifically applies where it's rabbinic prohibition, because people don't take biblical law lightly and people will assume you did it right. But if it's rabbinic, then people will make the assumption that you're just ignoring the rule. So there's more to be said about that kind of a distinction in a place where no one's going to know. Okay, what about if you're dealing with a Jewish assistant? So clearly you have all the problems you had with a non-Jewish assistant, right? You have the issue of them being your agent. You have the issue of paying them for work that day. You have the issue of appearances. But now there's another problem. Because I am putting a Jew in position to do something that the Torah prohibits. And this brings up the issues of Lifnei Iver and Misayeya, or as I called it in, right before number 9 in the heading, misleading or assisting in transgression. There is a basic prohibition, first of all, against literally putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. I am not allowed to do things that will cause people to perform actions that will harm themselves. I can't set someone up to hurt herself, to hurt himself. So if you take a look at source number 9 as an example of this, we have a prohibition. I am not allowed to purchase sheep or to purchase goats or to purchase wool or tufts of wool off of shepherds. Because remember the way shepherding used to work. For all I know, still does. I didn't look it up. But the way it worked was, shepherds would take people's animals for weeks, if not months at a time, and graze them and eventually bring them back. In the event that an animal gave birth to young, that was part of the flock. But you could envision a situation in which the shepherd tells the owner, the animal was stillborn. Or even better, the pregnancy happens entirely in the care of the shepherd, just denies that there ever was any such thing, and then sells off the animal. Or the shepherd sells off wool, or milk, or whatever it is. So the truth is that for milk and cheese, as you see in number 9, they generally had arrangements. The shepherd had an arrangement with the owner, because he's not going to bring in the wool, the milk and the cheese on a daily basis to the owner, so it's understood. The shepherd has the right to deal with that. But the other items are responsible to the owner. So I can't go to a shepherd to buy goats because there's a risk. The shepherd is actually selling me animals that are not his. However, I can purchase stitched clothing from them as opposed to wool because we don't assume that the shepherd is actually, number one, taking the wool off of the sheep, and number two, stitching it and making clothing out of it. We assume the shepherd just has another business. But the point is, why am I not allowed to buy what are essentially stolen goods? Because I am encouraging theft. That's the concern. It's lifnei there. I am encouraging the shepherd in wrongdoing. That applies not only where somebody isn't aware he's breaking the law, but even if he knows it's prohibited. In other words, you'd say to me, well, why is there any issue of lifnei iver? Why is there any issue of causing stumbling? This person knows the Torah doesn't allow it, and this person says, okay, but that's not where I'm holding. That's not who I am right now. They're not blind to anything. Nonetheless, if you look at source number 10, the Rambam Maimonides writes, Amar Hashem, he quotes God. That's generally a good starting point. He says, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. This means that if someone is blinded by lust or bad views, do not assist his blindness and mislead him further. It's not, you can't say, well, it's his decision. That doesn't work. So that's a concern. I have someone who is Jewish, doesn't observe. That's their decision. That's their right in a free country. But at the same time, I can't say, can you take care of this for me on Shabbos? I've heard horror stories like that. I had a friend who was Jewish, not observant, and he talked about how he was in a hotel on Shabbos, and he was talking to somebody who clearly knew that he was Jewish, and the fellow said, you know, I forgot to leave my door jammed or whatever it was that will be open. Can you take my key and open the door for me on Shabbos? Because he didn't want to do it himself. Like, no, you can't do that. If you think it's wrong, you can't ask somebody else to do that. That's a terrible idea. But that's exactly what we're talking about in this circumstance. You're not able to do that. That's number one. And then number two, you can't assist someone in wrongdoing. And there's some debate as to what exactly that means. Where is that from? It's a rabbinic prohibition. Whether it's part of this issue of not causing people to stumble, or as the Ritva in source number 11 says, it's that you're not allowed to because you have responsibility for other Jews. Right? We are all responsible for each other. You can't set them up to do something that is wrong, or is it a function of tochacha, my obligation to educate other Jews? However you slice it, though, this indeed is a problem. The only hope that I have that could allow a Jew to set up a Jewish assistant in order to do this is what's called talia. What does it mean to be tole in Hebrew? To depend, right? Dependent, right? Sorry, yeah. It can also mean hanging, but that's not what it means here. They come from the same idea, though. It's to depend on something, specifically to depend on the idea that maybe he's not going to do something wrong. This comes up a lot when it comes to inviting a Jew to come for a meal on Shabbat, and they live a kilometer away, so they could walk. I happen to know they drive everywhere. But they could walk, so the argument may be made that in certain circumstances it's okay to invite them if they choose to drive. That was their decision. What's that based on? Source number 12. Mishnah says, regarding selling tools, agricultural tools, in a Shemitah year, in a sabbatical year, when people are not supposed to work the ground. So, source number 12 says, this is the rule, one may not sell tools which could only be used for sin. But one may sell tools which could be used for prohibited or permitted purposes. So, if you give it to him, and you don't know that he's going to do it that day, so maybe there's some level of justification, but it's hard to do that. The Shabbat meal case is easier because maybe it's good, it'll help with a mitzvah, it'll create camaraderie and peace between people. You have arguments that you can make to justify it. Here it's harder, particularly where you know that this is what the person does and is what they're going to do with this as well. Yes, Miriam.
It's tax season, you're looking out in the bullpen, you know, Shabbatot, Chagim are falling through tax season, you go, I think I'd better just give it to a Gentile and, you know, not give the work to a Jew. And you may be sort of, you know, if everybody's thinking that way, that person might not get enough work during tax season. Like, is that what you really should be doing? That if you have a choice, take the non-Jew and is that?
I think the answer would still be yes, give it to someone who isn't Jewish. I think so. I'm not, you know, I have responsibility to look out for my brethren and to help them and make sure they get work, but not in that way.
But I'm not even talking Arab Chag. I'm saying, you know, you've got 20 returns, 30 returns to do. You know,
yeah.
And they could do it on Shabbat because they work on Shabbat. Are you really supposed to shy away from giving it to them even on a Monday?
I'd have less of a concern on a Monday. I'd have much less of a concern on a Monday. Yeah. But this is a good question. I mean, there's a lot more discussion in Jewish law about the issue of partnering with somebody who potentially is going to take, you know, even if they won't do the Monday work on Saturday, you giving them to this on Monday means that whatever else they have is going to get pushed down the line. There are issues like that that are, you know, beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about here.
How about a YouTube video?
What about it? They might watch it?
Yeah, that's right.
So I would not, as a matter of personal practice, I wouldn't, let's say 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, send, you know, an email to a fellow who's Jewish with a link to a YouTube video if I'm concerned that might cause them to watch it. But that's personal practice. I don't think that's halakha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was about getting them some.
I mean, I am. I'm wasting their time, which is a separate problem.
What's about telling them, listen, you know, this thing's got to be done.
So if you say to them, my preference, I mean, I had some discussions via Steve regarding, you know, practices in the industry, we'll say, about this, and it was noted, you can't, you know, in terms of the law, someone says, I want to work on Saturday, you can't deprive them of their ability to work. But as someone who's just giving him this work, and I can say to them, you know, I personally can say I don't want you to take care of my stuff, or I prefer that it not be done on that day. I just looked at the clock and realized how late we're running here. So we're definitely not getting to case number 3, but I want to at least address somewhat case number 2, which is the partner, just to at least frame what's going on outside of the sources which you see. When you're dealing with partners, you have a different set of problems. And this depends on what your corporate structure is. If I have a non-Jewish partner and I am paid because of the work that they do, then I have one problem. I am not, they are like my agent. I am benefiting from the work that they do on Shabbat, and that's seen in a passage from the Talmud that you have in source number 13. And even if this person does it entirely on their own initiative, I am going to benefit from the work that they are doing, and therefore this is a problem. And Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in his Mishnah Berurah in source number 14 notes that as well. Why is it a problem for me to benefit from the work that they do on Shabbat? So Gershon was sort of going in this direction before, but he quoted a different verse. There is a verse that says, Kol malacha lo ye'aseh bahem. Work, forbidden work, forbidden tasks, shall not be done on those days. Instead of saying don't do, it says the work shall not be done. It's passive voice. And so the concern is, I am enabling it to be done on Shabbat. That's what's brought in source number 15. No task shall be performed on those days. So that may be a reason why I'm not allowed to benefit from the work somebody does, because I am enabling this to be done. A second concern is what I brought you from Maimonides in source number 16, that if I'm benefiting from work that others are doing on my behalf on Shabbat, or with my benefit on Shabbat, there's a concern that I'm going to take Shabbat lightly. And then there is a third concern, which I brought from Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in source number 17, which is that if a Jew and non-Jew are partners in a business, then it really does seem clear they are each other's agents. One is exchanging his day for the other one's day. So that's a concern. And then there's a separate concern, again, for commerce. If I'm getting income from stuff done on Shabbat, even if it's not malacha at all, even if it's not forbidden work. I gave you an example. Source number 18, someone guards a cow just by standing there watching it. They didn't do anything wrong on Shabbat. They didn't violate Shabbat, but getting paid for it for Shabbat is fundamentally a problem. And this, of course, is aside from the issue of appearances. So what am I supposed to do? So the simplest thing to do is make an arrangement in advance. Someone mentioned this before. You make an arrangement. The arrangement is, I am not going to get paid for the work that's done on Shabbat. You create a partnership agreement from the get-go in which you exchange Shabbat, Yom Tov for other days with the person who isn't Jewish, and it's not a problem of trading days where you'll say, well, they're working for me, because you never had that day. You made the agreement from the beginning. You divided up the days of the week and said, this is yours and this is mine, and that's the way you can handle it. There is even a debate.
Partner going into a large partnership where there's many non-Jews, how do you practically do something?
So this is a really good question. If I got into this earlier, we could really talk more about the practicality, but I will note for you source number 19. Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram on the Shulchan Aruch, even suggests that you could make the agreement retroactively, so long as you can make a proper calculation of it. If you read number 19, he suggests one may not calculate after the fact unless it is known how much they earned on Shabbat, if you have the means of doing the proper math. That's one possibility. The other possibility is forfeit all proceeds from Shabbat and Yom Tov and just say, I don't want any of the money that comes in from that. Obviously, it's really hard to do when you're working with projects that are over an extended period of time to do it properly. So what do you do? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said, you're out of luck. He didn't like it. In number 20, he said he doesn't like that. Others disagreed. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, says what you're going to end up doing is simply dividing it up evenly. So you say, I assume that, you know, 1/7 is what was made on this day, and that's what you're going to play with if you don't have other choices. Yeah. So generally speaking, the way that a mashgiach will work on Shabbat is that the mashgiach is paid for the task as a whole and not hourly. Sorry? Or the rabbi. Same idea. They're paid hourly. But is the accounting done based on the week's hours like we talked about before, 30 hours or whatever it is? I don't think that that's true. I'm fairly sure you're not filing your hours at the end of Saturday saying, I worked 7 hours on Saturday and we paid for that.
I've done the paperwork. It's filed.
Then I have no justification. But I'm fairly sure
I've filed papers for years.
I understand, but I'm still fairly sure.
Experience.
Yeah.
But when I was given a one-to-one
tutorial by Rabbi Matthew Stern on Koa,
yeah.
He said he mentioned that we have a proper payment on Shabbos and Yom Tov, but he said if you are considering working as well during the week, then this could be considered also. You can
right.
Say you don't really care when you're paid, be during the week or Shabbos and Yom Tov.
Right.
I don't know what source he's relying on, but this is what I...
So what he's relying on... No, what he's relying on is the idea that, generally speaking, tasks, and I can't speak to the mashgiach role specifically, but tasks often require preparation in advance. So, for example, you have a youth leader who will run programs in a shul Shabbat morning, but they prepared all the materials on Wednesday, and therefore everything is absorbed together. You have a chazan who's going to lead the davening on Shabbat, but they had to practice during the week. They put in an effort during the week as well. There are other applications of that, but I think that illustrates it enough. We did not get to the issue of Jewish partners, which is a fascinating problem as well, where you're combining all the worst issues. You have the problem of profiting from work done on Shabbat, you have the problem of them being your agent, you have the problem of causing them to stumble, you have the problem of assisting them in wrongdoing, and there are things that can be done. Generally speaking, there are ways to deal with it, but it's not what we're going to... I'm looking at the time and realizing we're too late. So maybe we'll come back to it at some other occasion. Right. But God willing, next week, a much more philosophical discussion. Amazon HQ2 and tax incentives for business. Is that an acceptable... Does it sound economics, and is it sound within Judaism? So next week, God willing. Thank you again to Zeichman's for hosting and providing lunch. If anyone needs to bench and wants to do a mezumen, this would be a good time to do so.